Welcome to Unshackled Leadership, a lantern for Black women. This program is produced to help women of color in leadership move from their zone of excellence to their zone of genius by eliminating any false upper limits caused by race, gender, culture, or their own inner critic. This program is dedicated to the legacy of Harriet Tubman, who held a lantern in the dark for all of us. I'm your host, ICF-certified executive leadership coach, Joya Jefferson Nuri. Welcome back. I am so happy you could join us again. The struggle for women to be heard started way back with Eve. She didn't want to take full responsibility for eating that apple since Adam ate it also. Today, the debate on valuing women's voices and making her a full member of our society wages on. From suffragettes to Time Up, there is a constant drumbeat echoing out the words, "See me, hear me." My guest today is one of the very vocal and visible leaders of today's women's movement, Tina Chin. Tina is an executive vice president and chief strategy and impact officer at the Obama Foundation. She served in the Obama White House for both terms and was an assistant to the president, chief of staff to the first lady, and executive director of the White House Council on Women and Girls. At the White House, Chin spearheaded the first ever White House summit on working families. She helped form the White House Task Force to protect students from sexual assault and led the administration's effort to promote education for adolescent girls worldwide. Tina Chin, welcome to Unshackled Leadership.
I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. All right. So I want to tell the audience how we met. We were both speaking at a conference sponsored by the Open Society Foundation for 50 women from around the world who were political leaders who were cast aside because of the political situations in their country. It was quite an honor to be there. But what bonded us is when Tina spoke and she said she was a grandmother. I have to tell you. From fellow grandmother to fellow grandmother, I was like, oh yeah, we're the only women in the room qualified to be grandmothers since we were three times as old as every other woman in the room.
We were. Everyone else was a very young leader, which was very inspiring, but made me feel old.
Very young. Yes. So Tina, you started out in Columbus, Ohio. And I'm wondering how a Chinese girl in Columbus, Ohio, ended up in the White House. And you ended up with big law firms. I mean, it's a long thing, but just give me the highlights on how you made that transition and what was going on in your head during that.
Well, first of all, Joy, it's great to be here, and I'm delighted, and it's so great that we met at that terrific conference in San Francisco. And it's a long journey. So Columbus is where I was born. So some 68 years ago. So it's a long journey. And I didn't go to the White House until I was in my 50s. So there's a long journey there. But I was, you know, the daughter of Chinese immigrants.
Yeah.
And you know, my parents had just come over in 1949. Then I was born, you know, some 7 years later. We eventually wound up living in Cleveland, Ohio. So Cleveland is where I was really raised from the time I was in kindergarten, you know.
I was born in Cleveland.
No kidding.
I lived my youth in Cleveland.
Oh, my goodness. Where? In what neighborhood? Where were you?
In Huff, 150th St. Clair. Rough neighborhood.
It was rough. I know exactly where that is.
Yeah. So it was pretty idyllic at the time. I'm a couple of years older than you are, but it was pretty idyllic, you know, at the time. So please continue.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the eastern suburbs, so and in a Jewish neighborhood, which was, you know, very welcoming to this Chinese family. I think there were two Chinese families in that particular neighborhood. And then in the whole east side of Cleveland, there were only maybe a dozen families, and we knew them all. You know, we did dinners together, and, you know, we're coming up on Chinese New Year, and we did New Year celebrations and tried to keep the culture alive. And I have to give my parents a lot of credit. They actually also, with friends from throughout the Midwest, a lot of people from Chicago and Indiana, created a Chinese family camp that we would go to every summer. It was held in rural Indiana. So if you can imagine, you know, about 150 Chinese people descending in what was sort of Amish country in central Indiana. But it was like extended family that, you know, all of that my parents and their friends had left their families behind in China largely. So, you know, as young students in their 20s, and they were now, as they were raising their own families, wanted to create that sense of extended family. So there were aunties and uncles. And I will say, you know, we went every year. That camp has continued unbroken. I've taken my children there. We are still connected. We welcome new families. We welcome families that have adopted children from China into it. And so it's been an unbroken line for over 65 years, which was pretty amazing. And so that gave me at least a sense of, you know, attachment back to my Chinese culture. Then I went to college at Harvard, married a guy from Chicago, which is how I got to Illinois. So we got married right after I graduated. We're living in Springfield, Illinois. And so working for state government, but most of the time Springfield's kind of a small, you know, capital city, but in the center of Illinois. The luck, Joy, a lot of life is luck, right? And being in the right place at the right time. And I just happened to be there from 1978 to 1981, the exact years in which Springfield was the hotbed and the center of American feminism, because Illinois was one of the key last states that had not ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. And it became the focal point because it was the only northern industrial state that had not ratified. So ratification by Illinois was viewed as the key to getting the last three states that we needed to get the Equal Rights Amendment into the Constitution. So we were in Illinois, just that focal point. I mean, everyone came to town. Gloria Steinem came to town. Ellie Smeal really set up camp living in Chicago and in Springfield. We, you know, organized 100,000 person marches through Chicago. And then at the end, just before the, you know, extension time was about to expire. And so it was a very heady time for this, you know, new college graduate, you know, living in Illinois. And it was my introduction to being a feminist, to being an activist, to learning how to organize. And it stuck. So that was, you know, that first entree to what, you know, became a life's passion on working on gender equity issues.
I want to ask you, of all that, was a hotbed of a lot of issues that were coming to the forefront in this country. And so I want to ask you, what was the affinity to be beyond the fact that you're a woman, but it has to be more. What was the affinity to be a part of the women's movement?
Well, you know, I always had sort of a political interest. Like, I volunteered for my first political campaign when I was 12. My mother, I remember, drove me to the Eugene McCarthy headquarters to sort of, I don't know, I can't even remember what I was doing, what they would have put this 12-year-old doing, like copying names out of the phone book, I think, for the phone bank, something like that. But that was, I remember going to school with my, you know, notebook all emblazoned with McCarthy stickers. And so politics is always something of interest. But I do think, you know, started in college really thinking about the issues confronting women. I did a college thesis on the women's movement and learned all this stuff that I never knew about. You talk about Harriet Tubman, learning about Harriet Tubman, learning about Susan B. Anthony, learning about the hunger fasts, right, that it took to get women the right to vote. All the things you actually didn't learn in school. Remember, I went to high school in the 70s and college in the 70s. So women's studies was sort of not a thing, right, back then. All of the discovery issues, and you think about the knowledge that we just didn't have back then that I was stumbling upon and discovering along the way, like so many women did back then, you know, learning about ourselves. I'll tell you, Joy, I got a copy of Our Bodies Ourselves, and that's when I had a whole awakening, right?
That was my Bible.
Exactly. Our Bodies Ourselves was the whole way I learned about women's sexuality, right? That was the only way. It wasn't talked about anywhere else.
That's how we learned it.
And I think it's hard to imagine now how closed off all this knowledge was from all of us. And that awakening, I just went through all of that in that moment in Springfield. I mean, it was like a concentrated dose of it all at once, right? Yeah. And I was, literally 23, 24, 25 is when this was happening to me. And I was so, at that age, you're very receptive to it, right? I'm newly married. I'm trying to figure that out. Trying to figure out, you know, what do I really want to do with my life? I was working for state government, but that wasn't going to be what I was going to always do. And here came this rush of activity. And I had also had an abortion when I was 18. And so really learning about reproductive rights, I was just lucky to be able to do it, and had no full understanding until then of all of that went into that, all that went into my being able to go to do that, the threat that that was under. Right. Exactly.
And how much did it take to protect it? Protect that work years later, you know?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you should say this, because at that same point in life, in my early 20s, I was one of three Black women hired by NBC News worldwide to be a technician. And there were six of us hired in NBC Washington, and we learned to run the cameras, edit videotape, and blah, blah, blah. And the women's movement clearly then was where I wanted my heart to be, because the hostility we met wasn't because I was Black, because Black men were already there. It was because we were women. It was like, get the broads out of broadcasting and more foul things than that, okay, to get us out of there. But Tina, I didn't think the women's movement welcomed me.
Yeah.
It didn't back then. Gloria Steinem, and I admire her. I've met her. I've interviewed her. I didn't think back then, we're talking 68, 69, 72, right. 74, Watergate periods, all of that. The women's movement had no place for me. So clearly, being an activist, I went to the Black movement. Okay. Mm-hmm. But it didn't, even the Black civil rights movement didn't address my issues of being a woman.
Right.
And it was a very confusing time. And as I kept moving up through the media, getting more and more roles that were traditionally men, I felt like I didn't have a movement that wasn't me. You know, I had to be my own force, you know. And I hope that is changing for younger Black women today, that there is a space. And I just wanted to add, that in. So back to you. After you finished, you were in there, you were at the hotbed at the beginning of the groundbreaking of the movement as we know it today, you know, the beginning of that. What were your next steps? How did you stay in this movement? What was the drive to stay?
So at the time when we lost the Equal Rights Amendment, that was 1982, I was in law school. I'd gone to law school up in Chicago, but stayed connected. I came down to Springfield to help organize the last rally right after my, you know, law school term ended. But I was also an officer for the Illinois chapter of the National Organization for Women. I was the vice president. And through that was very connected, continued to stay connected to other women activists. And while I was in law school, a group of us, six of us actually, you know, decided we were going to revise Illinois' rape laws, which were some of the most antiquated in the country. We were probably ranked 48th or 49th in terms of whether our sexual assault laws were modernized. You know, we use the old term rape. It was defined as committed by someone over 14, you know, against a man, by a man against a woman. And, you know, all the things that were really kind of out of, you know, the 1600s. And
the law in Illinois was your husband, you could never be raped by your husband.
Correct. Correct. It had to be a man, you know, but against a woman, not his wife. That's the way the law ran. And we also know that age 14 made no sense, you know, because, and we had heard of gang initiations at 13 because they knew the kids couldn't be charged with rape if they were below the age of 14. So, and by force and against her will, I mean, all of the different elements that didn't work. So the six of us, you know, actually got together, wrote a new law, had a fabulous sponsor in then State Senator Don Clark Netsch, who let us actually sit at the drafting table with the legislators on all the aspects of this law. And we got it passed in 1984. And I think it was sort of the consolation, you know, to losing the Equal Rights Amendment was we were able to get this comprehensive law passed. But it was amazing. It was a great achievement. About the same time in Chicago, I was also involved in the Harold Washington campaign, volunteering for him. He was the first Black mayor elected in Chicago in a highly contentious, highly just filled with issues of race. You know, he defeated the old Black, the old white Irish machine to get the job. And he was, you know, a true dawning of the progressive movement in Chicago and coming together. And out of that, a group of us formed a organization called Cook County Democratic Women to elect women legislators. And, you know, and grew that. And I remember, you know, actually the mayor in 1987, when he was running for reelection, came to our endorsement session to announce that indeed he was running for reelection. It was one of our very fun moments. And people like Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky got her start at Cook County Democratic Women. So, and the other thing I did about little later than that. So I then went, I had my first child. It was right about the time Patrick was born in 1988 that we sort of realized that abortion was going to be something that would come to the states eventually. We didn't realize it would take then 40 years to the Dobbs decision, but we could see it coming after the Webster Supreme Court case. And we were at the time in Illinois, one of the most anti-abortion states in the country. Like every bad anti-abortion bill that was passed after Roe was decided and then, you know, taken up to the Supreme Court and knocked down came out of Illinois. A lot of them came out of Illinois.
So why do you think, I mean, Skokie for the Klan, is there any connection to that? Why Illinois?
You know, Illinois is truly a microcosm of the country. You know, we sit here literally at this, you know, we're not quite the center. I know Kansas is the true geographic center, but, you know, we are enough as the big metropolis that's at the center of the country. So, you know, we have everything here. We've got rural America, you know, downstate. We have old manufacturing, you know, America in both Chicago and in the collar counties and downstate. We have large swaths of immigrant populations. We have the largest population of Poles outside of Poland, like other than Warsaw. We are larger. The Polish population of Chicago is larger than every other city in Poland, other than Warsaw. We have the largest Palestinian immigrant population in the country. You go down the list, and then, you know, we were a mecca for the Great Migration. So we had, you know, the Black population in Chicago is, you know, just was a wealth of leaders and people who, you know, my law school, Northwestern, was a place where through the Great Migration, Black students could go to law school very early on. So that's where Harold Washington went to law school. And, you know, the man who went on to be, you know, a leader in our General Assembly, and you'll get to go down the list. So we have, I think, all of that, right? But not just one concentration of folks. We had, you know, then the Irish immigrants who were here, and our huge Italian immigration population that kind of just grew up over time because we were such a, you know, not, you know, a diverse city and how our economy works and who was attracted here. That's why.
The way you describe that, it sounds like that's why the fights are happening in Illinois. I mean, through the decades, it shows up in Illinois. Because every personality trait that is America lives on that patch of land, and they're fighting out just like they're like the Cold War for the whole rest of the country.
Well, and so It is true. But what I will say about what we did on abortion rights back then was all the women's organizations. At the time, I was representing the National Organization for Women, but the ACLU and Planned Parenthood, we all decided we would get together and only raise political money on abortion through one group. We weren't going to compete with each other. And there was already a pro-abortion political action committee called Personal PAC that a Republican suburban woman had founded and was just running off her kitchen table. And we all banded together to build up Personal PAC and stood behind it, hired an amazing man, a gay man to run it, who stayed there for 35 years. And over the course of those 35 years, Joy, we turned this state by focusing on, you know, candidates who, you know, recruiting candidates who would be pro-abortion in both Republican districts and Democratic districts, getting behind them, running independent expenditure campaigns to support them. We flipped the state. That's why Illinois is now sort of the haven for protecting abortion rights that we are today in a post-Dobbs world. But it's only because of the work we did 30 years ago. And I'm actually now working with a group of folks, some of us who were part of that original group around Personal PAC and others like Kathleen Sebelius. We now have a new national political action committee called Project 50 to try to take what we learned here in Illinois and go to places like Oklahoma and North Carolina and Arkansas, where there are women, you know, in these states that are banning abortion who are trying to, women and men, who are trying to really, you know, support abortion rights and giving them a playbook that we know has worked, even if you're in a deeply anti-abortion state where you can change political power and work at it. And we're, you know, we're trying to sort of take what we've learned here and get it into the hands of people across the country.
What does that physically look like? You say, give them the handbook. What I, you know, PACs do their work. I'm never quite clear what that actually physically means to me if I'm the woman in Oklahoma.
Yeah. So we're doing this a little differently than a lot of the, you know, like a Planned Parenthood PAC who comes in during an election year, drops a lot of money onto certain key candidates, goes on to the next election or the next key race. What we've done is actually try to take a look first at the states that have already banned abortion and therefore, you know, the women there and men are really in need and places where there is already kind of a core nucleus of folks to work with. And then we want to come in and work with them to build their capacity, meaning, for example, in North Carolina, which is a very key state this year, because if you will remember, last year in 23, there was an attempt to pass a 6-week abortion ban in North Carolina, and five incredibly courageous women senators stood up and filibustered that bill so that it failed. Three Republican women, one independent, one Democrat. They're all up in June in their primaries. There was a women's group that was organized as a 501c3, right, as a nonpartisan, nonpolitical, you know, charitable organization. And we talked to them, and we are now helping them actually create a political organization, right, a PAC, so that they can actually do electoral work. Right. Because that's what we believe. We are strictly an electoral organization because I believe you've got to go in there and find candidates. What we do is we also help them, you know, and sometimes we'll do it on our as an independent expenditure, you know, send out mailers that are really clear, because we have found that if you explain to voters what's going on, most voters, the majority of the country, and we've seen it in these places like Ohio and Kansas on the votes, they want to protect abortion rights. They don't want their personal freedoms to be curtailed.
This was something we held dear. Yes. This choice, to make a choice. And in all the reading I did around that, around the Supreme Court striking down Roe v. Wade, the most stunning information I got was the average woman who wanted an abortion was married and already had children. These were not a group of 16-year-olds,
right,
who had just gone wayward, you know. These were solid families. The husband and wife, or a woman by herself, or the husband, whatever, decided, we don't want any more children. We don't want to stop loving each other. We just don't want any more children. And for the state to try to mandate your family size is, for me, the most outrageous of it, beyond beyond a woman's right to choose, how would the state, who everybody's saying, you know, it went limited government, except when it comes to a woman's body?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, Jari, is it turns out when you frame this as an issue of personal freedom and an infringement of personal freedom, you get a lot of those folks in Republican districts because they believe in that too. You know, they're a little squishy more on women's health. That's not maybe their top issue if you frame it as a women's health issue, but they get the personal freedom issue. And, you know, the other scary thing about this, the big picture issue, is Mark Elias has this analysis, you know, the lawyer, you know, who does so much work on voting rights. You know, his view on it is this effort to take away personal freedoms is just the first step in a whole effort to infringe on our voting rights and freedoms, on our free speech freedoms, our freedom to assemble, you know, as we want. It's a real path towards undermining our democracy. You know, it's like the first step in doing that, which is the other reason to really fight back hard, because the first step in an autocracy is to constrain your personal freedom, right? And then it goes out, you know, further and constraining your freedoms.
Yeah, exactly. So then you go through this, you go through a lot of law firms. I think it was really interesting when I realized you worked for Skadden Arps in Washington. My memory of Skadden Arps is at some point the firm represented Ali North. And Ali North was represented by your firm, I mean, their judgment. And I was NBC News, what was that, CBS? The CBS, the technician sitting out front to see if we can catch a glimpse of Ali North coming in or out of the law firm. I have to tell you, every major network, because there was no CNN then, that I could recall, every major network, NPR, sitting out there, and never once did we see him approach the building. He would get to the door and wave at us and go through the door. I'm spooky. I mean, one morning he tapped me on the shoulder and went right past us all. I was like, give this guy his due. So at Skadden Arps, what was that like? I mean, it was called Skadden when you were there. You weren't Arps.
Well, it was Skadden, Arps, Slate, Marr, and Flom. It was five names. Everybody but Flom was, you know, had passed by the time I got there. The firm is probably now about 75 years old or so, because I remember I was still there when we celebrated the 60th. I was there for 23 years, Joya. I mean, I was there a long time. It really is how I matured into a lawyer and through my career. It was a large, actually, by the time I got there, they weren't doing that much political work. They did some political work in D.C. I was in the Chicago office. They were mostly known as a corporate law firm doing corporate mergers and acquisitions and large corporate deals. I was a litigator, so I was a trial person. In addition to doing the corporate work here in Illinois, I wound up actually representing the state, you know, for a long year, for about 13 years, and in cases brought against the state child welfare system, who's a budget I had actually done years before when I was working, you know, in state government. And that's the case I took to this, I argued in the Supreme Court, was that case. So I had a mix of corporate securities law, representing large companies, representing CEOs. And it taught me a lot. Look, I had a great practice. It was critical thinking, and I have a real understanding of how business works and how our, you know, economic system works, you know, as a result, that I think has put me in good stead, you know, in some of the policy work that was to follow. The firm, I will also say, had a deep commitment to pro bono work and to doing, and, you know, I was able to do all my, what I would call side hustles or my extracurriculars in, you know, continuing to work on things like personal PAC on the abortion rights and on the Chicago Foundation for Women, on, you know, the Chinese American Service League. I worked in Chinatown. You know, I at the time I left for the White House, I think I had to resign from 10 not-for-profit boards to join the White House. But in doing political work, I was always stayed active in my personal time in Democratic politics as well. And that's actually how I met the Obamas, like long enough ago that the three of us can't remember how we met. We've known each other that long. So probably back.
I want to go back a little bit to something you said.
Sure.
You said before the Supreme Court. And as you know, in my practice as a coach, I deal with women and their inner critic. That little voice that said, what the hell am I doing here? I'm not qualified. I'm not good enough. Why me? I'm going to mess it up. You're preparing to argue before the Supreme Court. I want to know what was going through your head.
Yeah. Well, it's even more than that, Troy. Let me paint the picture. So we have this case. It was decided on what's known as a preliminary injunction, right? The plaintiffs were trying to get an order to have the state government do something. So we were going up on, that means you move on an expedited basis, right? Because they want the order to take effect and we're challenging it. There was a constitutional issue around the scope of a federal statute that the plaintiffs were relying on. But while we were, so the Supreme Court agrees to take the case. You know, they don't agree to take many cases. Surprises us all. They agree to take the case. They agree to put it on a very quick schedule, which meant, remember, the term for the court starts in October. That meant, you know, in sort of in about that time period, we're writing our briefs. It was right. I'm writing this brief to get to the Supreme Court during the Clarence Thomas hearings. That's what was going on. Wow. So we're sitting in our office. I can remember vividly. We're sitting in our office trying to write our brief overnight. I got the hearings on over my shoulder, right? We turned the television on so we could watch the hearings. So the hearings are going on while we're submitting. So by the time we argued the case, which was Thanksgiving, it was the Monday after Thanksgiving, he was already seated. He's on the court. So I kind of had to go in after having watched all of that and argue the case in front of there, you know, with all that panoply. It was fascinating. I mean, I've only done it once. You know, I won't do it again because I'm not practicing law anymore. But it was an amazing experience because you're really close. What you don't see or you don't imagine is, you know, I think it's a barely big courtroom. You see these pictures of the nine people, you know, arrayed. They're in a semicircle and you are really right in the middle. Like you could almost practically touch the Chief Justice. You're so close to them. So it's pretty intimate. It's much more intimate than you realize.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. That's impressive.
But to your inner voice question, I think probably because I'm an Asian woman who has been in these positions a lot, I think, Joy, I learned early on, even if I really unpacked it in my psychology, back to even being in high school, right? So I'm the only Asian kid in my high school, right? But I was class president, and then I was student council president. I mean, I just kind of learned how to overcome that idea that I shouldn't be there. And so I think it actually goes back to being this little kid who got stared at in the grocery stores because you're not supposed to be there, you know, and when you move your way through that, I don't think I appreciated until I was much older the degree to which all of that grounding as a child probably gave me that inner strength, right? To by that time, the voice sort of wasn't there.
Right, right. That's very good. All right. So you and the Obamas don't remember how you met.
Right.
And so you are part of the fundraising people in 2008, correct?
I am. Yeah, right. I supported all his campaigns, including, you know, the Senate campaign, which was amazing. That was the first time I think lots of us felt the same feeling we had when Harold Washington was elected mayor. In fact, the night he was elected into the U.S. Senate, at the rally that night, I ran into an older Black woman who was so excited, and she showed me, she had a handmade sign that said Obama. And then she said, let me show you what's on the back of it. And the back of it had been a Harold Washington sign that she had made. So she had the two of them right together, which was, you know, 10 years apart. So I was always, you know, I was part of the crew. There was a lot of us in Chicago who were his early donors in a presidential campaign. You'll remember in 2008, it was supposed to be Hillary. I mean, the Clinton, you know, operation was up and running. And so being Obama supporters was being a little bit of an outlier, right? And the spoiler in the beginning in 2007 when we were starting. And then, you know, there was a group of us. We used to fly in our own dime around. People thought I worked for the campaign. I never did work for the campaign. I just took my weekends off and took vacation days and would fly to South Carolina and work the primary, or drag my kids to Iowa for right after Christmas for a week to work the Iowa caucus. And so it was great. I mean, it was an amazing time. And then he wins, right? It was like, who knew?
Him in the race, I don't want to speak for every African descendant person in this country, but in my group of people, him in the race was like, oh, poor baby. We're glad he's doing this. You know, good for him.
Yeah. Right.
But then when I think he won Iowa.
Yes.
And we're like, wait, hold on. Let's form our own little neighborhood pack. Let's give money. Let's get signs. Yep. Let's go around the country and knock on doors. Because now we thought if white people in Iowa would vote for him, he might win this thing.
So that was the strategy.
Huh? Say that again.
That was the strategy. That was the strategy.
That was the strategy.
That was the explicit strategy, was that if you could win Iowa, because we invested like, for a year in Iowa. We had folks who we paid who went to organize in Iowa in 2007, and they just lived in Iowa for a year, right? To get to, and by the time we got to the caucus, you know, they knew everybody in their districts. They had been there for a while. They got them to turn out, but that we knew explicitly if you could win Iowa, then you would demonstrate the viability of his campaign.
Very divisive. In the world I live in Washington, D.C., in a world that is a real blend of a lot of cultures into one space. And I found I was in several heated conversations with the white women I knew about not supporting Hillary. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure these conversations went on all across the nation, that as a Black woman, why wouldn't I support Hillary? And I'm like, you know, I get your point. That's a Black man. That's my dad. You know, that's what my grandson is going. Well, I didn't have any grandchildren then, but it didn't feel like I had a choice. It didn't feel like I wanted to have a choice. I wanted to support the race over the my femininity, but I just thought Barack Obama just had what it takes. There was just he's magical. He's Mickey Mouse. He's a superstar. You know? That just goes across all genders and appeals to people on so many heart levels. And so I just want to add that in. It's just that was 2007 was just magical. Just magical.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he knows that for the longest time, Black people that I know and across the country would use his name as a salutation. Did you know that?
Oh, no, I'm not sure I ever heard that.
People, when you would go, instead of saying hello, you go, Obama. They say Obama. You say Obama.
You know, they
say
Obama. Actually, on all these years, Obama. I'm not sure I knew that.
Yes, it went on for the longest as a greeting. Just say his name, Obama. So,
that's great. That's great.
I know you had lots of roles in the White House, but I really want to talk about Chief of Staff for Michelle Obama. Tell me what that role entailed and what it meant to you.
So she asked me, I was already running the Office of Public Engagement in the West Wing, right, where the President of the Oval Office is. And the First Lady's offices are in the East Wing of the White House, you know. So the White House is set up. You've got the West Wing, which everybody knows is very famous. Then when you walk eastward, you get into the middle of the heart of the White House, which is the residence, which was where all the fancy state dinner rooms are and East Room. And then you keep walking eastward and you get to the other wing of the White House, which is where the First Lady holds her offices as well as some other offices. And so it's known as the East Wing. And there's a lot of, like, does the East Wing get along with the West Wing speculation? If you go back and you read presidential histories, there's a lot of tension between when Nancy Reagan was first lady, or how did you know, the two Mrs. Bushes handle being first lady, East Wing versus West Wing. And so it was 2 years in, her, you know, our mutual friend, you know, Susan Scher was her chief of staff, but she, her husband was a judge and could not leave Chicago. So Susan was going back to Chicago. And Mrs. Obama asked me to come over from the West Wing to the East Wing to become her chief of staff, which was an incredible opportunity, you know, and entailed also stepping into the role of assistant to the president, which meant I would be one of the president's senior advisors. A small group of less than two dozen folks who are the closest in people, then have us, you know, be in charge of our staff. So I was both a policy advisor to her and then a manager of all the staff we had. So it's the social office that runs all of the events at the White House. It was our various policy programs that we wound up launching while I was there. So we had Let's Move on child nutrition, then Joining Forces on veterans and military families, Reach Higher on getting, you know, first generation and underserved kids to college, and Let Girls Learn, our final initiative on adolescent girls' education around the world. So overseeing all of that, overseeing the creation of all of those initiatives. Only Let's Move had already launched by the time I got over to the East Wing. So the other three, I really sort of supervised the building of those and the design of how we were going to interact. Everything that had to do with, you know, the family's life was sort of run by the staff of the East Wing. So making sure the girls were protected from the press, for example, or, you know, what kinds of scheduling needs needed to be to take into account, you know, the family schedule in addition to the official schedule. So that's what it entailed. You know, the thing about being first lady is it comes with no salary. It's got this huge platform, but she doesn't get a salary.
But free housing.
Right, free housing. Yeah. And no definition. Right, there's no definition of the job, so every person really, you know, can take it and make it their own. And unusually, what I learned as we started to do international travel, and we would welcome folks from other countries here, we are perhaps the only country that has 25 staff for the spouse of the leader. You know, the spouse of the prime minister in the UK, she has one staff person, or he has one staff person, half of whose their salary is paid for by the party and half by the government. You know, we're fortunate enough to have a tradition, I think going back probably to Eleanor Roosevelt, of very activist first ladies and using that great platform they have to promote, you know, various issues, and that we've been able to invest in that to make sure the first lady has, you know, the staff that person would need, you know, to pursue those issues.
She was quite the target. Good or bad?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
She was quite the target. I was amazed that she became a target when she said, eat organic food. Yeah. Like, we hate her for wanting to feed our children vegetables that were grown in the neighborhood where they live.
Yeah, like, that was a big Sarah Palin. That was a big Sarah Palin thing.
That was Sarah Palin, who is a whole nother interview. But I want to move into Time's Up. Mm-hmm. You left the White House. Everybody left the White House. And you were the executive, the CEO of Time's Up. For our audience who isn't in the movement the way you are, you know, I keep up with it. Tell us what Time's Up mission was.
Yeah. So the way I got into it, I think it's important to sort of go back to the origin story. I was practicing law. So I left the White House. I went to another law firm, a smaller law firm, practiced law. I was actually developing, even pre-Harvey Weinstein, I was developing a practice to help advise companies on doing better on diversity and inclusion. Because I saw that from the White House when we did the Working Families Summit. You know, a lot of companies wanted to do better, but didn't really know how to. Right, didn't know how to actually address these issues around women working and people of color and disabled people and how to advance them and how to keep them, you know, in their companies. So I was doing a practice already. I happened to be in Los Angeles about 3 weeks after the New York Times and the New Yorker magazine broke the sort of revelations about Harvey Weinstein, which was a whole series of kind of, he was a huge, you know, obviously movie producer, owned one of the most successful movie production companies in Hollywood. And they documented a series of him abusing his power, you know, and really committing sexual harassment and sexual assault against a whole series of really courageous women who came to speak out. And that prompted a lot of women like Shonda Rhimes and others spontaneously just to gather together in Los Angeles for meetings to sort of what to do and what's happening, and some who had themselves been survivors. And I just happened to be in Los Angeles for a different meeting, got pulled into that meeting. And what became clear out of it was the usual Hollywood machine to tamp down these allegations was getting in gear. And the usual machine operated by threatening to sue all these women for a slander, right, or defamation. And the women would cave because you couldn't afford to defend yourself, right? When you're in a lawsuit like that, there's no money to hire a lawyer for yourself. You've got the best lawyers in Hollywood going after you. And so in the past,
mostly in the
exactly.
Industry.
So that's how this kept silent for so long, is that they would sue and women would settle and they would have to sign, you know, a gag agreement to not talk about it. So, you know, I sort of figured out and then started to work with several different people that what we needed was a legal defense fund for these women. You know, that this is not the kind of case where there's money available to support them. And it turns out that lawyers who do this really don't get access to a lot of pro bono resources. The experts on it are some great people who are in very small, you know, law firms defending survivors. So, you know, the National Women's Law Center, who I'd worked with in the White House, I called their very, very new president, Fatima Goss-Graves, and convinced her that you should house this. It was a bit of a leap of faith for Fatima. And we famously, you know, launched it around the Golden Globes. I was not working for them, by the way, at this point. I was just, you know, an interested supporting person putting this together. But we launched Time's Up itself and the notion of the Legal Defense Fund around the Golden Globes, which was right after New Year's. We launched Time's Up on New Year's Day with a full page ad in the New York Times, and then followed it up with the black sort of ribbons and Time's Up stuff at the Golden Globes, and a commitment from an assortment of folks across Hollywood to commit, number was like $20-30 million into the defense fund all at once. It was the largest GoFundMe campaign that GoFundMe had, you know, at the time. And then we started doing that work of, you know, supporting survivors, but also trying to help companies to do better, right, and to be an expert on that. And about 2 years into Time's Up, we were looking for a CEO, and my friends on the board came to me and asked me to leave the law firm and, you know, go be the CEO of Time's Up, which I then did in 2019.
Yes.
Yeah. So we launched in 2017, and I went to, that January 1st of 2018, I went to work there in late 2019.
Yeah. But then something happened and you resigned. And
well,
for the life of me, I can't figure out how Time Out and you got involved with the Andrew Cuomo debacle.
So here's what happened. You know, we always had sort of multiple twin missions of both supporting survivors and continuing to support individuals through the Legal Defense Fund. But remember, we were the donor, and we were generating donations for the Legal Defense Fund, but it was being operated separately by legal experts over at the National Women's Law Center. The Time's Up was not, what Time's Up itself was committed to was doing system change, you know, systemic change for survivors. So that meant, you know, passing statutes or extending, for example, the statute of limitations for bringing claims, you know, better definition of sexual harassment requiring training, developing better training on sexual harassment, and helping and advising people who wanted to do better. I mean, I always felt that was an important thing to do, that you can't just make change by shouting from the outside. If somebody really wants to change, you have to help them from the inside, even if that might mean you're working with somebody who's got a problem, right? We started working with Andrew Cuomo not back then. We had started working with him the year before because he had championed pretty historic extensions of the statutes of limitation around rape and sexual assault in New York that allowed people to bring claims.
This is before
you. Oh, yes. This was a year before. This was a year before he was accused of this. So this is a year and a half. Actually, it happened to we actually participated. It was one of my first things I did as the new CEO. We participated in a bill signing with him on these statutes. I mean, a lot of the women from Time's Up had gone to Albany to actually push through and testify for these legislative changes to pass. He had championed them. We went to the bill signing. So he was making part of his policy agenda, working on these issues with us. And so we were continuing to work on those issues with us. Our board chair at the time was a New Yorker and got, you know, much more, you know, was very close to them, him, his chief of staff, you know, as we were working on this. And that's when I never talked to anybody a year and a half later, when in 21, right? The issues of sexual harassment and allegations came up, you know, against him that our board chair had sort of talked with them about some advice about what to do in responding to survivors. They didn't necessarily take the advice. Turns out what we didn't know until the Attorney General's report came out is they were sort of misrepresenting. They were saying like Time's Up is okay with all of this stuff. We were not advising them officially ever. I never talked to them. The Attorney General never talked to me or anybody at Time's Up for her report. She was just sort of going on the testimony of the people inside the Cuomo administration. That caused, understandably, the survivor community to be pretty outraged that we would have been talking to somebody like Andrew Cuomo during this moment. And I understand that. And I respect that. And I get it was perhaps harder to both be a survivor organization, you know, in support of survivors, and be an organization that was working from the inside with, you know, people who had committed it.
Yeah, because the media would make you believe, at least in the stories I read, that didn't give me this trajectory you just said. The media would left me believing that Andrew Cuomo called you to tell you, like his brother did, you know, give me advice on how to deal with these women. And I love hearing your story. I think the bigger papers, New York Times, Washington Post, told the story well, but there was so much out there that didn't tell the story well. And
oh yeah,
I appreciate you telling me the story well, because this perspective is totally different.
Yeah, you know? It is. Look, and part of it is we didn't talk that much because I respect the survivors, you know, position. We were in the middle of working through a change process. So this all broke in early August. It's been August and sort of into the early part of September, you know, thinking we could work through this. And I had a lot of support. I mean, I'm grateful for a lot of people in the movement who've known me for a long time and known that we were not doing this to undermine survivors. That didn't happen. But there's a lot of pain out there and there's a lot of anger, and I get that. And that's why I finally became that point where this was not about me. It should never have been about me or me keeping a job. You know, we want the movement to go forward, that I resigned, right? That you need to take yourself out of it at that point. And there were people in the years even subsequently said, I'm sorry you resigned because we were prepared to fight for you. And it's kind of like, that's not what the fight should be about, right? You know, I'm grateful for it. I'm very grateful for the support and the belief in me, but that's not what it should be about. And there are other targets out there that are the much bigger targets, you know, that like the folks who are doing stuff. So, you know, look, it's, you see a lot of it. I'm not the only person, you know, Joy, I'm not the only woman of color as a leader of an organization on the progressive movement in the last couple of years that's gone down. And there's something out there that is happening as women, you know, come into these positions. I'm watching these college presidents, for example, all women. who are getting, getting attacked in this way.
Officers committing suicide, Lincoln, because of the harassment. There is something else out there. There is something that we can't guard against. That is maybe not physical harassment, you know, or assault, but there is a psychological piece that's going on that is crippling us in our movement up. It's a weight around our ankles. It's sometimes hard to identify.
Yep. And it's setting ourselves against each other, which is sort of something I sort of said in my, you know, resignation statement, which didn't go over well with some people, but I believe, you know, that was like part of the reason for my stepping down was we're going after the wrong targets, right? We need to, you know, go after people who are harassing or people who are, you know, truly discriminatory, right? And it's a distraction to, you know, I think what's that's happening on the progressive side. That's very unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there are rabble rousers amongst us who are responsible for a lot of that. The misinformation. Yeah.
And I will say, Joe, when it happens online, I happen to be somebody who doesn't read comments, so it doesn't really bother me. But when it catches steam online, I do believe we have to be wary of it. This is the whole misinformation thing, as you say, right? Because once something gets picked up and gets velocity online, you have to step back and question about, is that really the voices of true individuals, or is it the bots out there that are have caught an issue that is to their advantage to foment, right, and to stir up?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I always encourage people and myself, when something catches fire like that, spend the extra 10 minutes to go find another source.
Exactly.
Then an extra minute to see what the Associated Press had to say about it. See the longer story and then see how you think about it. And the worst part about it is it catches fire online and then you go to a cocktail party and somebody's repeating the ignorance.
Yes.
And somebody now says, I hear, and then it's just ignorance, ignorance, ignorance. It's like telephone and it's all wrong. It started wrong. And so, no, I can appreciate that. And I do appreciate you explaining that. That was, thank you for that. Thank you.
Sure.
Now you're with the Obamas.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you're with the Obamas. You know what? I want to switch in one other thing. You went off to do and handle the sexual abuse charges at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now that's a renowned civil rights organization, human rights organization. Tell me about that work. Just tell me briefly about that work.
So that was when I was at the law firm doing this practice, right? As I mentioned, on assisting, you know, companies to make change. And so I was brought in kind of to do, Morris Deese had already resigned. He was the founder who had been accused of sexual harassment charges. He had already resigned by the time they called me. So I was coming in. And so it was less about an investigation to get someone to resign or to, and more about an investigation to sort of see what the organization needed to do to heal itself, right? And to get better and to build better systems. And look, this was an organization like a lot that had been founded by a charismatic leader. The founder was still there. You know, they had never made the transition from a founder-led organization, right, to a long-term sustained, you know, institution, despite their size and their critical mission. And so we spent time, you know, working with the board, working with new leadership over time, you know, with the sort of recommendations we made. They, you know, brought in new leaders. Their board has changed. They now have an Asian American woman leader of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and a Black woman deputy. They have, you know, made the, you know, a lot of the changes. One of the really interesting things about them that I learned in that process is we interviewed, you know, part of the Southern Poverty Law Center's job is to investigate and basically go undercover with hate groups, right? They have a whole division. One of their incredible services to the rest of us is they read all this terrible stuff that none of us want to be exposed to, but they report on it and they report on the prevalence and they're tracking where it's happening. Because if we don't know, we cannot turn a blind eye to the fact that it's happening, but they are doing this service for the rest of us by really tracking. And they really do, they go to meetings undercover and find out what's really being said in neo-Nazi groups and in Klan groups. I didn't appreciate the toll that that takes on people who are doing that. Because some of, you know, you can't, if that's your whole day job, it starts to seep into you and you, it starts to seep into the way you behave yourself. And so sort of building up some supports for staff who are doing that is one of the other reforms. I will say the other project that I did, because I just watched the Grammys the other night, is I led the task force on these issues for the Grammys. So when the Grammys had an issue with their former CEO, you know, making some statements, right, about, you know, right, women. And so that was another organization that just was a longstanding legacy organization that hadn't changed with the times, right, and hadn't figured it out. And what was, we had a terrific task force with people like Sheryl Crow and Common and, you know, others on it working with me, executives from Universal Music and Sony. And we really dug into some of the structural issues around how the Recording Academy is organized that just sort of perpetuated the way the membership, you know, gets elected, the way their board is created. Therefore, that's the voting, you know, pool for voting on the awards, which sort of explains why that things came out. And it was, we made some, a really interesting set of, they're all public, you know, 29 or so recommendations that they have worked their way through. And, you know, I watched the Grammys the other night and women dominated and, you know, hip hop was there and celebrated and, I'm encouraged because that those fundamental changes, you know, happened and we now see it in, you know, still evolving and still working on it, as Jay-Z pointed out, but remarkable change from, you know, that Grammy show from the other night is so vastly different, you know, than anything, you know, you saw in the previous years. And, you know, a lot of that had to do with that work of that task force.
Bravo for you. Bravo to you. So as we're concluding, I want to know what you do for the Obama Foundation now.
So I came in as both the Chief Strategy and Impact Officer and also to help oversee the Girls Opportunity Alliance, which is Mrs. Obama's signature program here to continue our work on adolescent girls and helping them reach their full potential. But as Chief Strategy Officer, I am here sort of pulling together a cohesive strategy for the entire foundation, which runs not only the Girls Opportunity Alliance, but My Brother's Keeper, which is our program from the White House around young men and boys of color, our global leaders programs, where we have, you know, sort of mid-career leaders from Africa and Asia Pacific, Europe, and now the US going through a leadership training program and then becoming alumni that are connected to each other. And our work here in Chicago is together with this very large effort of ours, which is to build the Obama Presidential Center and then operate it and to really pull a strategic vision around that. So it's critical because we are, you know, only, you know, less than 2 years away from opening. We will, you know, our scheduled opening is October 2025. It is both a museum, an eight-story museum about, you know, not just the Obamas, it's about democracy. It's about the story of our country. But it sits on a 19-acre space that will include, you know, a forum building, a restaurant, the John Lewis Plaza, the Eleanor Roosevelt Fruit and Vegetable Garden, a branch of the Chicago Public Library, it's large, great lawn that will be, you know, suitable for sledding in the winter, but watching movies on in the summer, and 1.5 acre playground and restored wetlands and new athletic center. We'll have an athletic center.
Yeah.
And we're located on Southside right next to some of three of the most disinvested neighborhoods in the city. And we are sort of committed to developing and bringing this economic opportunity in a way that will benefit first both the kids in that neighborhood and the businesses in that neighborhood, but then the broader south and west sides of Chicago. And, you know, I believe we'll transform actually the landscape in Chicago because we are this new cultural institution on the south side that will really pull tourism and business attraction further south in the city, which is much needed.
That's beautiful. And hopefully you'll protect that community from having big chains like Starbucks and Whole Foods overwhelmed.
I have said that. You are singing my song, Joy. I have said one of the things we want to do is, so here's one thing we did was just north of us is the pretty well-known Museum of Science and Industry, which is a terrific place. And they built an underground parking garage, but you can go from the underground parking garage at the Museum of Science and Industry directly into the museum. You never have to go outside. Like you could leave your coat in your car, in the car. We deliberately built, right. And we deliberately built our parking garage, you know, I don't know what the square footage is, but like, you know, you have to come outside the parking garage because there's the museum, there's the forum building, there's the library, then there's the parking garage. You have to come up out of the parking garage and walk across the campus to get to the building, even in our very windy winters, because we wanted people to come outside. We wanted them to see the campus. We want them to walk across the street. And I've been saying to everybody, we need to help development across the street. We have the opportunity to create a great commercial corridor, but I'll be damned if it's a national chain set of restaurants across the street. We need to have the local coffee shop, the local sandwich shop, right?
Yes.
The local swag shop to buy your keychain. We are very conscious of that, Joy. It's one of the things we were excited to work on.
Good. And as we conclude, I want to bring up something I brought up in the beginning. The women's movement didn't have a role for me in the 1970s because of the color of my skin, and my issues were not whether or not I can put my name on a credit card without my husband. Okay. My daughter is 32 years old, business owner, mother, and wife. Is there a place for her in the women's movement now? Are we reaching out to the average woman, like the woman who works in the post office, not just the movie stars?
Yeah.
No.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, as with all things on diversity and inclusion, it's something I got to always work on. But I contrast it with my experience in the 70s, where the late 70s, people sort of knew there was a problem, but still weren't sure how to fix it, right, in terms of bringing people in. I think one of the things, for example, that we did when I was still CEO of Time's Up was to work together to create, you know, a care coalition to work on issues of expanding caregiving support, you know, through, you know, the early Build Back Better days led by, you know, the Domestic Workers Alliance, you know, and SEIU and other, you know, advocates of working women, you know, because I felt as CEO Time's Up is important to join forces on that, to sort of figure out how are we going to have more childcare resources and more elder care resources and support the mostly Black and brown women who are those caregivers and increasing their wages and their support. Yeah. So I think right now, you know, the abortion rights movement is a lot about women of color and low-income women who Planned Parenthood is their only source of healthcare. You know, so these attacks, you know, to try to do away with Planned Parenthood, you're really trying to do away with healthcare access for low-income, low-wage women, you know, who need that care. And so I think that, you know, across the women's movement, there's a real awareness of those issues, some amazing leaders, right, that are, you know, leading that movement in a lot of spaces. The Black Women's Reproductive Health Collective, you know, are really giving voice to the reproductive justice aspect, not just reproductive health, of what we need to pay attention to when we're fighting for abortion rights.
Tina Chen, thank you so very much for joining me today. This has been
a delight. Thank you. Oh, yes, great. Yes. I enjoyed it. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Yes. We've learned a lot. And hope you'll come back and visit us again before October 2025.
I would be delighted to.
That has to do with women of color. We'd appreciate it. All right. Thanks, everybody, for joining us for this show. We'll see you next time. I want to thank you for joining us for another episode of Unshackled Leadership, a Lantern for Black Women. I want to thank the people who make this all possible, beginning with our senior producer, India Tisdale of It Takes Pure Effort Consulting. And our program editor is Grammy Award nominated singer and obviously extraordinary editor, Carolyn Malachi. Dominika Eldridge of Unique Creatives created our phenomenal artwork. And Hotham of HothamMusic.com created the theme song that you listen to every single show. Again, thank you for joining us, and I hope that you will be here for our next episode. Peace and blessings.